Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Philip Ackerman Lieberman, assistant professor of Jewish studies and law, assistant professor of religion, and affiliated assistant professor of Islamic studies and history, about his recent book, The Business of Identity, Jews, Muslims, and Economic Life in Medieval Egypt. Phil, thanks for being willing to talk with me.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Great. I thought I'd start off with a general question, which is, I wonder if you could give a brief historical sketch of medieval Egypt. What was the context for the activities that you're describing in your book?
Yeah, the Jewish community of medieval Egypt is interesting to us because in many ways they are socially and economically integrated into the Islamic context. That is to say that we think that they did business, Jews did business with the Muslims and the environment around them. We have questions asked of medieval Jewish legal authorities like Moses Maimonides. What happens if a Jew and a Muslim have a partnership together? What happens to the prophets that come on Friday that the Muslim isn't supposed to receive, or the prophets come on Saturday that the Jew's not supposed to receive? They want to keep their shop open 7 days a week, obviously. we see in that case kind of friendly relations. At the same time, you know, there are a few events in Islamic history moments in Islamic history that are difficult for non-Muslims living in Muslim contexts, so-called dhimmis, Jews and Christians. There's a case in the early 11th century where the caliph, the Islamic kind of religious and political leader, goes a little bit mad and ends up destroying some churches and synagogues, and so on. A few years later, ends up rebuilding them. But other than that, the period in which I deal, the 11th to 13th centuries, is in many ways a kind of a golden age, because those kind of interfaith relations are typically pretty friendly. And those contacts extend beyond business to personal contacts. We don't have the Jews living in just one area of Cairo or Alexandria, but there's kind of interreligious residential communities, and so that those relations are really pretty friendly. Now, over time, we think that as the empire called the Fatimids, who rule in Egypt from 969 to 1171, give way to their successors, some folks called the Ayyubids. Most famous Ayyubid is Saladin, right? From 1171 to 1250, and their successors, the Mamluks, that the Ayyubids and the Mamluks kind of make life a little bit more difficult in some ways. But the Fatimid period itself, the period in which I spend most of my time, is, as I said, a kind of golden age.
Now, central to your book is what's called the Cairo Geniza. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what a Geniza is for people that wouldn't know, and what's so special about the Cairo Geniza.
Yeah, so occasionally, as an instructor, I'll get papers where someone will write the word God, G-D. Right? Uh-huh. And these students don't want to, write God's name and then crumple it up and throw it away, just as, we in America don't want to take our flag and throw it away or step on it or whatever, but you dispose of it properly. Jewish law and tradition has it that if you write God's name down, you're not supposed to throw that piece of paper away or treat it disrespectfully, but traditionally you bury it. And in fact, if you go to some Jewish cemeteries, even today, you'll see a kind of a headstone, which is a location where people have buried old documents with God's name, old sacred books, and maybe old Torah scrolls, right? So this practice, probably has a long life to it. And the Jews of medieval Egypt, used every side of a piece of paper, right? Unlike us, where we, recycle and it gets repulped, right? They take a piece of paper and they write on the back and they write in the corners. And when they'd used up most of it, then they'd give it to their kids to practice their alphabets on, right? Another thing that they did was, they talked about God all the time, right? We might say God bless you when someone sneezes, but these folks are saying, God bless you in letters, and God's name's invoked in legal documents and stories and so on. And so, as paper was kind of put aside for reuse, right? When it was done, when folks were done with that piece of paper, instead of throwing away, it might have God's name written on it somewhere. Rather than throwing it away, they would take it to the synagogue, and there was a room at the back of the synagogue that they would shove that piece of paper. And then eventually the idea was someone would go in that back room in the synagogue, take all the papers and bury it in the cemetery, maybe in some kind of ritual burial, actually. We don't really have evidence for what might have taken place, but we do know that no one actually bothered cleaning up the back room of the synagogue. Okay? So that synagogue was rebuilt in the early 11th century after one of these events, as I said, where the caliph went a little bit mad, and people had been shoving papers in that room from the early 11th century all the way up until the middle of the 19th century. Now, in the middle of the 19th century, we start to see European travelers coming to Egypt, right? Think about Napoleon's expedition in 1798, right, where he brought along with him a number of scholars. And so they not only brought artifacts back to Paris, which, you know, you can see as you walk along the Seine, but also scholars who drew images of what they had seen. So over the course of the 19th century, we see travelers, right, wealthy Europeans, begin to make the voyage to Egypt and try and bring back artifacts of Egyptian culture. So in the middle of the 19th century, people knew that there was this place in the back of the synagogue that people had been shoving papers for a long time, the Cairo Geniza. Now, one great thing about Egypt is they get about half a centimeter of rain a year, right? And so documents that were in that Geniza were exceedingly well preserved because it's such a dry environment. Okay, so you know, at the end of the 19th century, a character named Solomon Schechter, who was a reader in rabbinic literature at Cambridge University, learned that there were some documents in the Geniza that he thought were particularly interesting. He got on a boat and went to Egypt, took the you know, the documents that hadn't been sold off by unscrupulous traders, threw them in boxes, carted them up, brought them to the Cambridge University Library. And so one of the major collections of documents from that collection, the Cairo Geniza, is at the Cambridge University Library in England. Now, what Schechter was interested in is what we might call classic texts. Schechter was turned on to the Geniza when two of his friends, who were Scottish widows, went to Egypt and some unscrupulous character had sold them some old Hebrew manuscripts. They showed it to their friend when they came back, and they actually could read it themselves. But he immediately identified the document as the Hebrew text of an apocryphal book called the Book of Ben Sira. Now, Schechter knew the book from Greek, because a couple centuries before the year zero, right, the book had been translated from its original Hebrew into Greek, and it had been known throughout the medieval period up to Schechter's time in the Greek. And in King James, right, the Bible is translated from the Greek, right? So Schechter knew the Book of Ben Sira from the Greek and from the Greek translation. He hadn't seen it before in Hebrew. So when he saw this document, he thought, wow, you know, I've come across this book. It's Eureka moment, gets in the boat, and so on, retrieves the document. So Schechter was interested in classical texts. Early stages of scholarship around the Geniza, late 19th, early 20th century, focused on classical texts. Versions of the Bible that we hadn't had, manuscripts of the Talmud that we hadn't had, and so on. Over time, scholars came to realize that that wasn't all the Geniza was about, but those Jews who had taken those pieces of paper and shoved them in the back of the Geniza not only had copies of the Torah on hand, but they had their personal letters and shopping lists. And just imagine if I went into your garbage can, right, or a garbage can in the library, right, you might find all kinds of interesting stuff. I ask this of my students all the time, right? Imagine you went into your email garbage can, right? Because that's sort of the equivalent today. Or your physical garbage can. I'd see your credit card bill. I'd know where you ate for dinner. Or what you ate for dinner. I know where you ate. I'd know what you really did over the weekend, right? And so, you know, unlike what you told your parents that you did over the weekend, right? So, you know, the Geniza is an amazing resource for social history, for history about daily life. And that's what I get to work on.
Right. Great. Thank you. Now, we're moving a little bit into the arguments of the book with this question. Among other things, and I don't mention this, so I should mention this right off. Among other one of the things that your book provides are some translations of some of the documents. I just want to make that clear to folks that are listening, because I don't really address it directly with any of my questions. But among other things, what you do in the book is you argue with the methods and conclusions of a group of scholars known as the Princeton School. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about who these people are, what claims they've made about Judaism and Islam in medieval Egypt, and how they've used the Cairo Geniza to substantiate these claims.
Sure. So You know, when I spoke about the early stages of Geniza scholarship as focusing on kind of classical literature, the successor to those kind of classical researchers like Solomon Schechter were characters like a guy named Shlomo Dov Goitein, who's born in Germany in the year 1900, makes his way to Israel in 1923, and then eventually in the 1950s comes to the United States, where he teaches at the University of Pennsylvania for a while, retires, and then ends up at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in 1970. Now, where Goitein, in his early work, was focused on classical texts, some from the Geniza, and then over time, realizes the Geniza is a great resource for social history, begins to write social history. Now, when Goitein makes his way to the Institute for Advanced Study in 1970, he's joined in 1970 by another character, Clifford Geertz. Right? And so, you know, Geertz is using anthropological evidence to draw this kind of thick description in very much the same way that Goitein is trying to do the same thing. Goitein's magnum opus is a 5-volume collection with an index, a 6th volume, called The Mediterranean Society, that starts to come out in 1968 and then comes out all the way. Goitein works on it all the way up until his death in 1985. Subsequently, the index volume came out. So Goitein calls a Mediterranean society because he looks at the Geniza documents and tries to tell the story about not just a Mediterranean society, but Mediterranean society as a whole. So one of the central questions that is really underpinning Goitein's work is, to what extent can the Geniza documents, which are written by Jews and about Jews, right, tell us something about the world in which they lived, right? Now, of course, sometimes you learn stuff about the world just kind of, by the by. Someone will say, well, I traded in indigo, right? So that means that someone is using indigo presumably to dye something, right? So you learn, about trade routes, about commodities, and so on from that kind of detail. And some of that detail is general and some of that isn't, right? We know, for instance, that slaves were traded in the medieval period, but Goitein says, look, I never came across a single document in the Geniza suggesting that the Jews traded slaves. So, are the Geniza documents descriptive of the broader population? Well, if we say they are, well, who traded the slaves, right? And if we say they're not, then we have to figure out how we're going to use the Geniza documents as a tool for the social history of the medieval Mediterranean world. Right. That is to say, if we had an Islamic Geniza, right, we wouldn't need to use the Jewish Geniza to tell us what happened, right? So scholars have, when they realize the riches of the Cairo Geniza, have tried to figure out how we can use the Jewish Geniza documents as a proxy for the broader medieval Islamic Mediterranean. So Goitein, coming up in Weimar Germany, I think, and then living in the United States in the 1950s, really felt that being a good Jew meant being a good German, or when he came to America, being a good American. And so in many ways, he felt, bringing that idea of his own personal experience to the Geniza, that the Jews in medieval Egypt were kind of, good citizens of the Fatimid Empire too. And so a lot of the detail that you found in the Geniza could be extrapolated to and assumed to be descriptive of the Islamic world. One of Goitein's students, if you will, was a character named Avram Yudovich, who recently retired from Princeton and from the Near Eastern Studies Department. He actually was one of my teachers and mentors there. Avram's book, Partnership and Profit in Medieval Islam, expands on his own doctoral work, which kind of surveyed the major schools of Islamic partnership law. And then Avram looked at the Geniza documents and said, wow, if you look at the Geniza documents, all the same ideas about partnership are reflected in the documents that we see are reflected in Islamic commercial law. So what that means is that the law that we see in the Islamic legal codes actually played out in daily life in the documents. And therefore, what we see in those Jewish documents is probably descriptive of the broader Islamic world. Jews and Muslims probably traded according to exactly the same trading patterns and so on. And by the way, if you think about the way that Jews operate in 21st century American economy, there's probably not that much that Jews do that is really different. Now, they might or might not buy pork, right? But, in terms of their business structures, right, they still buy houses with mortgages, they still trade in mutual funds and so on and so forth. right? So Yudovich really kind of became the vanguard of the Princeton School of Geniza Studies in using the Geniza documents as a way of describing the broader Islamic world. And Yudovich's students, of whom he had a number, who are now emerging as prominent scholars of Jewish and Islamic studies and using the Geniza documents to that end, have gone with this idea that the Jewish documents are largely demonstrative, descriptive of the broader Islamic world. Now, that's exactly one of the things that I try to challenge in the book.
Right. And I want to get to that. But first, I want to ask, though, sort of a detour question, which has to do with your background. The title and the subtitle of the book indicate that this book is focused on business and on what doing business together says about identity. And you studied at the London School of Economics, so I'm curious about how that background has played into this project.
So not only do I have a master's degree from the London School of Economics, but I also traded options for a number of years.
Okay, wow.
I at one point was a member of the American Stock Exchange and the New York Futures Exchange. And so I like to think that I have a sense of what it means to be active in the marketplace. And so hopefully that's given me a sensitivity to some of the economic issues that are at play in the documents.
Mm-hmm.
So, I like to think, I had a pretty long career in graduate school, spending a total of 12 years in graduate school. And, I like to think that I bring all the diverse pieces together in this book.
To bring the scholarly, the business.
Yeah.
So going back to your arguments with the Princeton School scholars, you note that these scholars have tended to focus on the letters in the Geniza, whereas you spend your time mostly with the legal materials. And you find that there are three kinds of business arrangements in the legal materials, and you talk about these relationships at some length: agency relationships, ordinary partnerships, and investment partnerships. So what are these, what do these mean, and what do they demonstrate about Jewish identity?
Yeah, so, agency relationships are, pretty simple. I ask someone to go, to the store and buy something for me, right? That person's my agent. What happens if they don't do it, right? What happens if they, they buy chocolate ice cream and I really ask them to buy vanilla, right? So, Jewish law is pretty extensive about, how agency law works. But agency law is also the most informal piece of these partnership agreements, right? In the case of partnerships, you and I might both do something for each other, right? We work together for the partnership. We share an investment, right? As an agent, you just do a favor for someone. Mm-hmm. And in return, I might do a favor for you, quid pro quo, right? And that's how many of my predecessors have thought most relationships in the medieval period were managed. Traders would be at long distances for one another. And in their letters, they would say, would you please buy me some saffron, right? Would you please sell the wood, right? And so, the report comes back of the price, right? That's a sort of standard, agency agreement. But in the case of a partnership, we both invest money. We both invest our work. We both work actively for the partnership. And each of us might have some discretion. So rather than being your agent and buying, chocolate ice cream when you told me to buy chocolate ice cream, I might decide, I think that the price of Rocky Road is going to go up. And so I'll buy that, right? So in that way, right, partnership gives each of us the discretion to trade as we like. Now, investment partnership feels like a partnership in many ways because it does involve that discretion. But in the case of investment partnership, you have one person who's the wealthy investor, and you have someone else who's actually the active partner, the administrator, who goes off to foreign lands and invests that money.
Right.
Okay. And so, when I was on the American Stock Exchange, I often would see young traders start out by working for a company. And after they'd done that for a couple years, they'd find someone maybe wealthy on the exchange to back them. Right, and then they become a partner with that, with that wealthy backer. Now, if they would, succeed as a trader, earning money for that person, they would have some kind of split. Okay, you get 10% of whatever you make. But if they lost money, right, they wouldn't necessarily be on the hook. These are young guys, right, and they had their backer, their investor, right, who, again, was bearing all of the risk, sharing the profits, but bearing all the risk. Now, Islamic law has the partnership structure or investment partnership that follows that model, right? That is to say, profits are split. All the losses are on the shoulders of the investor. Now, Jewish law, for some various reasons that have to do with trying to avoid the appearance of lending money at interest, right, looks at things a little bit differently. Profits are split between the investor and the administrator, and losses are also split, although the person who's actually doing the work, right, the actual trader or administrator, doesn't have as large of a share of losses as he does of the profits.
Mm, okay. You don't simply, in the book, you don't simply describe these relationships. You kind of go through what I would call sort of the life cycle of of a business arrangements. So what, can you sketch that kind of life cycle out?
Yeah, so Avram Yudovich, when he looked at the letters of the Kairouganisa, came to the conclusion the vast majority of transactions took place through informal agency relations.
Mm-hmm.
And that if people did have to use formal partnership, they used it basically at the beginning of their relationship. As they were getting to know one another, they might use a formal partnership, and after that succeeded, you know, all right, so we contract for a year. If everything's good, right, then we can simply engage in informal agency relations. Just imagine if you, let's say you're renting out part of your house, right? So things are good with your tenant for a year. After that, you might say, okay, we'll go month to month, rather than forcing you to, you know, kind of hang on a contract. And so over time, right, Yudovich's account is that partnership relations begin formally and then tend towards the informal, okay? My account's a little bit different because I discovered that, you know, looking at the documents of the Ganisa, sometimes I would find the same characters having a partnership. At the end of the partnership, they would release each other from any future obligations, and then they would re-partner, right? So, you know, if all the partnership was about getting to know one another, why would they do that, right? And so the conclusion that I came to after looking at a big swath of legal documents from the Ganisa is that that act of releasing each other from future obligations provided folks who might be very distant from one another, one trader in Egypt, another trader in India, one trader in Egypt, another trader in Spain, right? When they came together, they would release one another from future obligations, they would do an accounting.
Hmm.
So coming to the court, which was located in the synagogue, gave them an opportunity to kind of commune, to, you know, meet up once again, and then after they had done their accounting, they released each other from future obligations. And then their partnership went on to a new stage.
Mm-hmm. So, and becoming partners would sometimes involve this ritual, I guess, kinyan. What can you talk a little bit about?
Yeah, that's correct. One thing that that I identified, and you know, all Jewish legal documents pretty much have something called a kinyan, and the kinyan is an act that effects a change in status. If you think about the role of legal documents in general, right, how is a legal document different from a letter? A legal document either recognizes a change in status or it actually effects a change in status, right? And the act, the ritual act of effecting a change in status is, in Hebrew, the kinyan. Okay, now, where you have someone purchasing something, right, that's a legal transaction, there's a change in status. The kinyan is typically someone lifting something up. That acknowledges, oh, I buy it, right? You go to the supermarket, right, you buy something, you lift it up, and you take it away, right? That's the Talmudic kinyan, lifting up. Now, if you're going to partner with someone else, you can't really lift them up. So
unless they're very light.
Unless they're very light, right. So then you effect, yes, and by the way, the kinyan is the act that's involved in marriage, too. So you don't necessarily want to lift up your partner. Though. So these folks would engage in the kinyan, some symbolic act of acquisition. What I think they would do is they would take the investment in the partnership, they would put it in a common purse, and they would lift that up.
Mm.
And by lifting up the purse together, they symbolized their new partnership that was starting.
Okay. Now you use other materials besides the Kairouganisa to make your argument, various Jewish and Islamic legal materials, and you read the legal texts and the Ganisa in light of those materials to, you know, sort of demonstrate when the Ganisa texts are showing sort of Jewish identity or Jewish practices rather than Islamic practices. And you also argue that it is not adequate to claim, as some folks have, that business practice shapes Jewish law without considering that Jewish law may also have shaped business practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the mechanisms by which you see Jewish law shaping business practice.
Yeah. So for me, this is a really interesting question. So let's say that, you know, we look at the Geniza documents. We find out that the Geniza documents perfectly reflect what we see in traditional Islam or Jewish legal codes, right? So does that mean that the Jewish legal codes actually affected practice? Or does it mean that, you know, or, you know, as you point out, right, that the people who are writing the legal codes looked out in the marketplace, they saw what was going on there, and that's what they wrote down, or that, you know, that's just kind of happy accident, right? You know, my argument is that, you know, if you go on Route 65 here in Tennessee, you know, you'll see that the sign says 70 miles an hour. It doesn't mean that people are driving 70 miles an hour, but there is a kind of a dialogue going on there. And I situate that dialogue in the court, in the Jewish court, in which, as I said before, is located in the synagogue. So when partners come to effect a partnership, right, someone's going to write an agreement for them, right? That's a court scribe. And someone's going to sit them down and say, look, this is what a Jewish partnership looks like. And the court scribe is going to go ahead and write your agreement. It doesn't necessarily have to accord in all of those details with what Jewish law has to say. It's your choice, right? But this is what a Jewish partnership might look like. Hmm.
And I'm not remembering exactly, but you talk about various mediation relationships, mm-hmm. and you sort of identify what's going on in the courts as one particular kind of educative sort of mediation relationship.
Yeah, I love to use the example of divorce, because I think it's a very contemporary example. So two people are getting divorced, they have a kid, here are three different models of mediation. Okay, model mediation number one, the mediator sits them down in a room and says, okay, I'm going to shut the door. You make some kind of agreement for taking care of the kid, and when you're ready, you come out. Right? So that agreement could be, you know, the kid is, you know, with mom during the academic year, with dad during the summers, with mom during the week, dad on the weekends, or it could be Tuesdays and Thursdays with mom, Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays with dad, right? You know, whatever they work out, right? That's something called norm generating. Hmm. The individuals, the partners, make up some kind of norm for themselves, right? This, the kind of model in the middle is, as you described, what I would call norm educating, mm-hmm. where the mediator sits them down and says, look, this is what normal people do. Here are a few different models, right? As I said, you know, mom during the week, dad during the weekends, mom during the school year, and so on, right? And now you can do whatever you want. So their agreement might look very different from the norm, but they know what the norm is. Mm. And maybe many of the agreements will look like the norm for that reason. The third model is what we might call norm advocating. Now here, the mediator says, look, this is what normal people do. I'm going to shut the door, and you can come out when your agreement looks like that. So because if you look in the documents of the Cairo Geniza, the agreements often look like Jewish law, but not always, right? For that reason, I don't think we have a norm advocating situation. On the other hand, if you look at how court practice worked, people came to the synagogue, the judges, if you will, were educated in Jewish law. Many of them were actually involved in commerce as well. Mm. You know, the judge was not necessarily a paid position. And so, you know, they made their money as merchants. And so for that reason, they could kind of unpack to partners what a Jewish agreement might look like. And so much of the time, that's what the agreements actually do look like. That's the norm educating model.
Okay. You have mentioned marriage practices, and that kind of leads me nicely to this question. To ask a little bit about how what goes on in the description of these business practices might apply to beyond beyond other things in the society beyond business. You write how the Jewish merchants whose record is retained in the Geniza chose to collaborate and manage their economic relationships is actually representative of how these merchants and by extension the Jewish community at large managed and structured all their relationships. So I wonder if you could give some examples of how you see this sort of larger relationship sort of structure operating in the larger society, the Jewish society.
I think the signal example is actually something you touched on a little bit when you talked about the kinyan, right? This act of acquisition. Now, Islamic law knows about the idea of partners putting their investment in a common purse and lifting up the common purse. There's only, I think, one school of Islamic law that absolutely requires that, though. And the school of, there are four major schools of Islamic law. The one that most of my colleagues think most closely like represents practice in the medieval Islamic Mediterranean because it was most flexible was the Hanafi school of Islamic law. Hanafi school of Islamic law actually doesn't require that that partners, when they initiate their partnership agreement, put their money in a common purse and lift up that purse. Mm. Okay, but Jewish law does require it. And one thing that I argue in the book is that Jews who could have the option of lifting up the common purse or not, when they decide to structure their relationship according to the constructs of Jewish law, to take that money, put it in a common purse, and lift it up, they're going to think about other similar situations in which they initiate partnerships but through some kind of ritual act. And marriage is, I think, the kind of, again, the signal example. Mm-hmm. So when Jews decide we're going to lift up the common purse, they may in the back of their head be thinking about other situations in which they have to initiate a partnership, in this case a marriage, by some kind of ritual, mm-hmm. right? And so when they take on certain aspects of partnership, another one is the, is as I said before, Islamic law does not require the administrator, the active partner in an investment partnership, right, to bear any responsibility for losses. But Jewish law does. Mm. And so, you know, one thing that I argue is that as you take on more discretion, right, as, you know, you're not an agent, but you're actually a partner, you have the opportunity to choose chocolate or vanilla ice. You're not just buying the, you know, the one flavor that your fellow asked you to buy on his or her behalf. As you take on more discretion, you take on more responsibility. And so one thing that I'm arguing in the book is that that idea of responsibility resonates in other aspects of Jewish life. And so rituals of initiation, the axis, if you will, of responsibility, these are pieces that resonate in other aspects of Jewish law and ritual and life. And therefore, what I'm arguing in the book is when merchants decide to engage in this ritual or to take on this responsibility, which they didn't have to in either case, mm-hmm. that they're doing it in order to resonate with other aspects of their decidedly Jewish life.
Right. Okay. So it's like it's you're trying to get sort of a holistic in a way.
Yeah, the book is a little bit anthropological in that way, I would say. Yeah. That, you know, you can take something that goes on in commerce.
Right.
Geertz does this beautifully, right?
Yeah.
We're going to look at this one ritual. We're going to say something about you know, what makes this people tick?
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I hope I do in the book.
Yeah. In the last chapter of your book, you propose a paradigm for continuing to use the Cairo Genizah materials to describe aspects of the medieval Islamic world. And you do this even, as you've said, even as your reading of the Genizah legal materials as distinctively Jewish would seem to militate against using them, as the Princeton School has done, as a source for Islamic practice and a window on the dominant Muslim culture in medieval Egypt. And you call your paradigm the specular relational model. What does this mean, and how does your model work?
Yeah, so the as I said, many of my colleagues have looked to the Genizah documents as kind of descriptive, not only of what Jewish merchants are doing, but what Islamic merchants mm-hmm. are doing. And since we don't have an Islamic Genizah, you know, there have been a couple caches of documents that we found. So it's not as though there are no documents from the medieval Islamic world, but, you know, where you have somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 fragments in the Genizah, right, you can see that, you know, somehow mining its riches for, you know, not only Jewish life, but for Islamic life is an important desideratum. So my colleagues have looked at the details in the Genizah documents and understood those to be descriptive, can simply be mapped onto the Islamic world as a whole. Now, I try and take a step back and say, look, rather than looking at the details, at the level of details, let's look at relationships in the system here, if you will. Jews, as I said, were educated by courts as to what Jewish law had to say. And there's some kind of relationship there, just as Muslims were educated by Muslim courts. And so if we see a relationship between Jewish life and Jewish law, maybe we can speculate that there is a relationship between Muslim life and Muslim law. The specular piece is, you know, what, you know, how does that relationship get kind of transmuted, if you will, as it carries in the, you know, the Jewish world over to the Islamic world? How do you take that kind of structural relationship between Jewish life and Jewish law and speculate that it would have, you know, corresponded to Muslim life and Muslim law, because we have essentially three pieces of this this model. We have Jewish life in the Geniza, we have Jewish law, and we have Muslim law. Right? What we don't have is documents from some Islamic Geniza. Right, so that's the piece that we have to kind of speculate about. So if we can look at the one structural relationship between Jewish life and Jewish law, we can speculate there's a similar relationship between Muslim law, Islamic law, and Islamic daily life. The Geniza documents seem to hew fairly closely to Jewish law, and therefore we might imagine that even though we don't have an Islamic Geniza, that maybe Muslim daily life hewed somewhat closely to the sources of Islamic law.
I wanted to close with a question that sort of comes out of this last one, which is a larger question, philosophical question, I guess. What is the role of speculation in history writing? Because I mean, that's kind of what you're doing in this last chapter. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that.
So an article recently, not related to this project, I got some peer review feedback, and it said, the author has drawn together details from a number of documents, from a small number of documents, with some creative historical exegesis. And my response to this peer review feedback was, the peer reviewer has eloquently outlined the job of the medieval Jewish historian. Because, we don't have the kind of evidentiary detail that we have in the modern period, right? I was recently speaking about this character, Shlomo Dov Guaitan, whom I mentioned before, and I was looking at some of his early writings in newspapers in Israel. Lo and behold, you can just do a web search and the newspapers will come up. Newspapers in Germany, newspapers in Israel, and so on, from the early 20th century. We don't have these materials for the medieval period, right? The job of the modern historian is to cull from the data, but for us, we have to connect the dots. And so that speculation is always going to be a piece. Mm-hmm. And so, what I hope is that I'm contributing a story that coherently brings together the data points, and as more data points emerge, a new story will come about. And so hopefully my work is just one stage that may well be superseded by someone else's story with a richer data set.
Thank you, Phil. This has been a good conversation from my point of view, and hopefully from yours as well. Again, I've been talking with Phil Ackerman Lieberman about his recent book, The Business of Identity, Jews, Muslims, and Economic Life in Medieval Egypt, which was recently published by Stanford University Press in the series Stanford Studies in Jewish History and Culture. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.